Joshua chapter 2. Joshua facing a military challenge. Jericho is before them. Jericho, certainly at the center of the trade route that came through that part of the world into then Egypt, the Via Mares down through the Jezreel Valley, then down the Jordan Valley, and Jericho and south, the wealth that would travel from Damascus or from Tyre and Sidon, sometimes even from the area of Babylon, down through that area. Fortified city. Scholars tell us that it was 9 to 10 acres inside, roughly imagine the size of our property here inside the city. And inner and outer wall, 30 to 40 foot high, the walls. And Joshua and the children of Israel are looking at that as they're encamped in the fords of Moab down by the Jordan River. The Jordan is at flood tide, we're told in the third chapter, verse 15, overflowing its banks, most places probably a quarter mile to a half mile wide. Challenges in front of them. Joshua sends these spies. Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out of the acacia grove two men to spy secretly. Now, is that secretly in light of the children of Israel or secretly in the land? You know, I have a feeling that Joshua was a little gun shy of this whole spy program. It set him back 38 years already. And he remembers the last time spies were sent in. And God turned them away. And I know that at 100, he doesn't want to wander for 38 more years. So maybe he figures, well, the last time we did this, we sent in 12. 10 came back with an evil report. 2 came back with a good report. I'm only sending the 2 this time. And when it says he sent them in secretly, maybe that means he was the only one who knew because he didn't want them to come back and give bad news to everybody else. We're not sure. It doesn't tell us. But he sends these two spies in saying, go, view the land, even or especially Jericho. And they went and they came into a harlot's house named Rahab. And they lodged there. Now, it was common. They come into Jericho. There were no Holiday Inns in that day. It was common an inn in a pagan society that it would be run by a prostitute, a harlot. And probably most of the time the patrons would partake both of room, lodging, and her services. Sometimes just the room, these two men, that would be very normal, unobtrusive. They come into Jericho and enter into the house of this harlot named Rahab in Jericho. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, there came men in here tonight of the children of Israel to search out the country. And the king of Jericho sent unto Rahab, saying, bring forth the men that are come to thee, which are entered into thy house, for they be come to search out all the land. Now, it's interesting. Notice his security here. No doubt very paranoid, because as Rahab will speak to the spies, she says, we know God's given you the land. The fear of you and your God has fallen on us. Our hearts have melted. We're terrified. So, you know, here you have to imagine, here's the king of Jericho, and it's less than 5 miles to the edge of the Jordan River from where he is. And on the other side of the Jordan River, there's 2 to 3 million Israelites encamped, and there's a pillar of fire there at night. Imagine standing on the walls of Jericho, looking across the river, and seeing this huge camp with this giant pillar of fire going up into the sky. And she's going to say, we're terrified. We heard how God parted the Red Sea. She's impressed. Not the Reed Sea. She's not saying, we're impressed you got through a muddy swamp. She says, we're terrified. We hear how God parted the Red Sea. And we hear how you defeated the kings of the Amorites, Sihon, who terrorized the whole area, and Og. 13 foot tall, one of the giants up in the area of Bashan. Steve was able to track down for me a book printed in the 1860s by archaeologists that had been up there called The Great Cities of Bashan that give great detail about these buildings they found, homes they found with 16 and 18 foot ceilings and 6 foot hinges on the door, doors that are over 12 inches thick, stone doors that still sit on sockets that turn, and just immense proportions. It tells us in Deuteronomy there were 60 cities of the giants in that area. So she said, "We've heard what you've done. Maybe the reason the walls of Jericho were so high to keep them out. Your God is part of the Red Sea. You've slaughtered the tribes of giants and had great victories. We heard, or we're very paranoid. So this king has a great security system. They're watching. Two men come into a city. There's always traffic and always flow and always business, and yet they're noticed. And by the time evening comes, the king already knows where they are. They're at Rahab's place. I don't know if that's what it was called, Rahab's place. But neon sign outside Rahab's place. I'm not sure. The king is well informed. The woman took the two men and hid them and said thus, "There came men unto me." Seems normal enough. Harlot. "But I wist not whence they were," which is King James for, "I didn't know who they were." "And it came to pass about the time of the shutting of the gate, when it was dark, that the men went out. And where the men went, I wot not," is, "I don't know. Pursue after them quickly, for you shall overtake them. But she had brought them up on the roof of the house and hid them under the stalks of flax." That's an interesting note there. "Which she had laid in order upon the roof. And the men," that is of Jericho, "pursued after them the way to Jordan unto the fords and the chevies." Now, this is a snipe hunt. I don't know if you've ever been on one. If you have, you know what a snipe is. These guys are out hunting for something that doesn't exist. She sent them out. She lied. People want to write chapters about this. A harlot that lies. I don't understand. Situational ethics. Should she have lied? It's okay for the spies to be dishonest because they're on a covert mission for God. It's espionage. But what about the woman? Is it okay to lie? Well, you know it's not, or you wouldn't be troubled by the fact that she lied. What that means is it's not okay for you to lie. It was okay for her to lie, but it's not okay for you to lie. I guarantee you God was worried about more than lying in her life. And we're accountable for the amount of light that we walk in. She knew nothing of God's law, nothing of God's word. She had only heard of this true and living God. And she puts her life on the line to protect these two men. A prostitute in Jericho meant nothing to the king of Jericho. If he found out she was lying, he would cut her to pieces and throw her carcass to the birds. And I don't think she thought twice, "Gee, is it right? And he really shouldn't lie." I don't think there wasn't that conviction. I think instantly she said, "Well, I didn't know who they were. They were here earlier. You're right. They're gone. I don't know where they went. Yeah, probably went out when the gate was shut, got getting dark. If you head out after them now, you might catch up with them." And she had taken them up on the roof and she had hid them there. There are tremendous dynamics here. As you read the chapter on your own and you sit back and you look at it, you realize here is an entire chapter written about a prostitute who lives on a wall. Two spies are sent into the land, Jericho. The things we know about Jericho, we know from the archaeologist. Its size, the heights of the wall, estimated height of the walls, the double walls, those things. We get none of this information from the spies. We get none of the information that statistically or in regards to strategy for a battle or for war. You know, it seems that you would send spies in, like we have covert operations in Baghdad to decide what sites to bomb, that they would go in and come back with some military strategy. We need to do this. When you sit back and you read this, you realize they go in, they spend a night at a prostitute's house, they escape, they come back to Joshua. Joshua must have said, "What'd you do?" And he said, "Well, we got into Jericho, we stayed at a prostitute's house, and here we are." You take another step back. And you realize when you consider the big picture that the plan of the ages is being enacted. It will be this land and a city named Jerusalem. Where the plan of the ages will be enacted. And God had made this promise to Abraham hundreds of years before this. Abraham, this is your land. Walk through the length of it and the breadth of it. All that you see will I give to thee, and to thy seed. Your seed will be like the dust of the earth. Abraham, the iniquity of the Amorites has not yet come to a full. Genesis 15:16. I'm going to take your descendants down into Egypt for 400 years. In the fourth generation, I'll bring them out. And Jacob and Joseph, and the story of what happened in Egypt and how the children of Israel were brought there during the famine and forged into a nation, and the passion and the slavery and the taskmaster's whip and the crying out to God, and Moses and his failure on the backside of the desert in Midian for 40 years, and then speaking to the burning bush and God commanding him, and the whole act of the Exodus and the Passover night and the passing through the Red Sea, being in the wilderness for 40 years. Pillar of cloud during the day, pillar of fire at night, manna falling from heaven. All of this bringing millions, between 2 to 3 million Israelites to the shore now of Jordan, to the border of the promised land, to inherit. To finally be brought in to this promise made to Abraham, this plan of the ages being enacted. And yet, remarkably, in the middle of all of this, God pushes through all of this to one prostitute living in Jericho, whose heart had been turned toward him, and sends his messengers to her, living on the wall. No one is a pawn in God's sight. We knew a man in Austria who was friends with a doctor, a prominent physician named Dr. Larry Samuels, who had a very successful practice in Europe, was in an auto accident, got amnesia, and lost his practice. Jewish doctor. A number of years later, he accepted Christ. He was saved, and God began to restore his memory, and he had a very successful practice again. Well, when Golda Meir was dying, she called for Dr. Larry Samuels to attend her on her deathbed. And we heard through that source that Golda Meir accepted Christ before she died. Now, someone heard me say that and had the chutzpah to call Dr. Larry Samuels out in Indiana teaching nuclear medicine at a hospital, a university hospital out there, and say, is this true? And he said, look, I'm not going to say what you want me to say. Because he said it was Menachem Begin and I that stood at her casket in her funeral, and I'm very good friends with the Begin family. He said, I'll say this to you. Golda Meir had a very enlightening spiritual experience before she died. He said, maybe someday I'll write a book. But as I listened to it, I thought, no one is a pawn to the Lord. He might use one woman to help establish a nation, but she's never just a cog in the machinery. She's never just a pawn to him in his plan. He gets a doctor and gets him in a car wreck and has him lose his memory and takes away his practice and gets him saved and restores him and takes this long, who knows, 30 or 40 year journey to bring him next to her bed so that she might hear. Gets his spy in the right place. I think he can do that in Washington too. And it's all about God's love reaching this woman. And I'm sure, because she's going to say, we know that God has given you the land. We know that this land is yours. We're terrified. We've heard that all of your God has done. He is the God in heaven above and in earth beneath. And no doubt she had been praying. She had been seeking this God. There's evidence of a change in her life. You know, in the New Testament, some try to say, well, she's Rahab the innkeeper. That's nonsense. Both places in James 2:25 and in Hebrews 11:31, it calls her Rahab the harlot. Uses the word in the New Testament for immorality. She was a prostitute. Her life had been changed somehow. It says here that she took these men and she hid them in the flax that was laid out on a roof to dry. Now, very laborious job. Cutting flax was in this season when the Jordan River would be overflowing its banks in the spring. And the flax was cut and then it was brought and soaked and then laid out in the sun to dry, and then the stalks would split open as the sun dried the shell around the stalk, so you could kind of peel out the fiber from the center of the stalks of flax, and then that fiber would be woven into garments, into cloth to make garments with. And often in this part of the world, that cloth would be dyed red. And that was a process where they took some of this brilliant red stone from down in the area of Petra and Edom, and they would crush it and they would boil it in a big pot on a fire. And the pigment would come out of the stone, and they would put a rope in there and lay that rope in there because they didn't have containers to keep their dye in. So they would lay the rope in and boil all the water off, and that bright red pigment would get into the rope. So that if at some point you wanted to dye a piece of flax garment, you would take 1 foot or so of that red rope and cut it off and put it in the pot and boil it with that garment. It says this in Proverbs 31 of the virtuous woman, a virtuous woman who can find her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he has no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax, and worketh willingly with her hands. Would be very unusual for a prostitute to be going through all of the trouble of laboring to dry flax and produce dye, unless there had been a change in her life. This is Jericho. It's like Las Vegas. It's like Atlantic City. This is a good place in that sense, business-wise, for a harlot. It wasn't that she lacked business. Something was changing in her life. And she must have been praying to this God that she didn't know, but she knew of. And she must have heard, this is a God of power, but a God of love. Her patrons, she said, we've heard, must have told her, oh yeah, we have business in Egypt, but there's a big mess down there, and all, you know, hell and fire, and you know, business is destroyed, and all the slaves have left, and some miracles happened. Their God took them through the Red Sea. Must have been listening to all of this, because the prostitute in that day was like the psychiatrist or the bartender. You get to hear everything. And somehow in that, she heard, this is a God of slaves, a God that's willing to take slaves and make a nation, a God that's willing to set people free from bondage, a God that's not ashamed of taking people from under the taskmaster's whip and making them his own. And she must have thought, God, the God of heaven and earth, if you're really there, I'm a slave. I'm a slave to sexual sin. I'm a slave to my financial situation. I can never get out from under this. Lord, if you're really there, set me free from this bondage. If you're not afraid to be associated with slavery and slaves, O Lord, send me some messenger. Somehow let me know. Two guys at the door. And she must have realized when they came in, they didn't look at her, unlike other men. They looked out the window. They looked at the city. They looked over the wall. And then she heard the messenger from the king of Jericho come and say, okay, bring us the Israeli spies. We know they're there. She heard that. She said, thank you, Lord. Israeli spies come to my door. She took them up on the roof, hid them under the flax, and sent message to the king, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I don't think she ever thought about a lie. I think she had her hands lifted and was saying, thank you, Lord. Verse 7 says, the men of Jericho pursued after them the way of Jordan under the fords. And as soon as they which pursued after them were gone out, they shut the gate. That's what they did at Jericho at night. And before they were laid down, speaking of the Israelite spies, she came up unto them upon the roof. And she said unto the men, I know, not I've heard, not I think, not could it be, this is remarkable, I know that the Lord, notice, capital L-O-R-D, Yahweh, I know that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all of the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. Romans 10:17. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did unto the two kings of the Amorites, which were on the other side of Jordan, to Sihon and to Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts did melt. Neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord, your God, he is God in heaven above and in earth beneath. Now, therefore, I pray you, swear unto me by the Lord, since I have showed you kindness, that you will also show kindness unto my father's house, and give me a true token, and that you will save alive my father and my mother, my brethren, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. You know, I look at this and I think, what a rebuke to the nation of Israel. What a rebuke to the spies. You know, here's a harlot on the wall that says, we know God has given you the land. The whole country, our hearts have melted. There's no more strength or courage left in us. We've heard about your God. He is the true and living God. And we know the land is yours. So certain is she says, swear an oath that when you come in and take the land, you'll preserve my life and my family's life. And here are the children of Israel, you know, 38 years earlier. Joshua, probably when he heard from the spies, said, I knew it. I knew it. I knew it 38 years ago. I knew the land was ours. I knew we could have went in. She must have said, what took you guys so long? You've been wandering out there for 38 years. We heard about you when you came through the Red Sea. Why didn't you just come right in then? Your God's the God that divided the Red Sea. This land is nothing before him. What a reproof it must have been for them. And I think for us sometimes, you know, I see Christians get in this frame of mind sometimes about the devil and binding this and doing this and the threats to the church, like, you know, like kind of this boogeyman mentality kind of a thing. I think that the enemies of God, both spiritual and physical, tremble. Because they know. I think it was a reproof to them as they heard this. I want you to swear that you'll keep alive my father's house, my sisters, my brethren, everything that we have. And the men answered her, our life for yours, if you utter not this our business. If you keep this quiet, you have our word. And it shall be, when the Lord hath given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with thee. Then she let them down by a cord through the window. Now down in 18 it says a scarlet thread. You know it's not a thread or simply a cord because full-grown men were able to slide. It was a rope. She let them down by a cord through the window For her house was upon the town wall, and she dwelt upon the wall. Now, this is amazing. You know, imagine this harlot. You know, imagine how disappointed her parents must have been to find out your daughter becomes a prostitute. You know, they had lived with that. Even in a depraved society, still, I can't imagine that mean anything but heartbreaking. And now this woman's going to go to her parents and say, Mom, Dad, God has spoken to me. They must be thinking, yeah, we know. And he's going to preserve me. Everybody else in Jericho is going to die, but he's going to keep me alive. This sounds like a likely story. How do you know? A couple men came to me tonight. Yeah, what else is new? No, Mom, these were different men. And this is what happened. And if you'll come to my house when the children of Israel come to destroy the land, they told me if I let this scarlet rope hang out the window, that our house will be preserved and all that are in it. Imagine what a solitary faith that is. She has to stand alone in the middle of Jericho and believe that. She has to go to her parents and tell them, our future depends upon the scarlet rope hanging out the window. In one sense, you know, that's so ludicrous. It's like the blood of the lamb on the doorpost or the lentil on the Passover night. It's this scarlet cord, which she doesn't realize is a royal bloodline, you know, hanging out her window. It's when we get saved, you know, here we go, Christmas time, we're gonna see friends and relatives that are not believers, and we're gonna say, yeah, this is the season Christ came into the world, and all you need to do is trust Jesus. You'll be saved. Just trust that scarlet line. That's all there is. It's not Rahab, hang this scarlet rope out your window and vacuum. It's not hang the scarlet rope out the window and genuflect. It's not hang the scarlet rope out the window and do some other thing. It's simply the most illogical, in one sense, thing. It's just faith. You hanging out the window and it will be honored and your life will be preserved. And remarkably, the spies, now they don't know anything, they go back to Joshua. They say, well, this woman, you know, their hearts are encouraged because they've run into this woman. The woman told the whole land is terrified. It's open before you. Your God is the God of heaven and earth, and this is going to be yours. Their hearts are encouraged. You go back to Joshua. This woman cut us some slack, you know. She saved us, and we've made a promise to her. Joshua said, okay, great. What's that? Well, we told her we'd come to the land, and when we have victory, that we'd preserve her and her father. And then, great, that's good. And where does she live? She lives on the wall. Joshua probably said, that's not good. You know, while you were gone, God told me the walls are going to fall down. And the two spies don't know what's going to happen. I mean, were they marching around the walls of Jericho going, come down the rope now, quick, you know. And here's Rahab in the house with her parents, and the children of Israel come. They look like they're going to attack the city. They walk around at one time silently and go back to Gilgal. And her parents must be thinking, red rope, huh? And she's saying, Mom, Dad, that's what they told me. Just imagine the situation she was in and the faith that she had to exercise. It tells us in James 2:25 that the way she dealt with these spies was an evidence of her faith, that her faith was genuine, that those were her works that proved that her faith was real. It tells us in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31, that she received the spies, interestingly, in peace. You know, there was no threat to her life. She must have been praying. When they come to her door, she must have said, thank you, God. Thank you. She received them in peace, was not threatened by the king of Jericho and all of the other things that were going on around her. Not threatened by those things. And I think it's important for us to look at, because, look, our house is built on a wall too. It's called America. And it's going to fall. It has to. God's not going to let the world have its hope in democracy. The systems of men are going to crumble. It's going to happen sooner or later. But how wonderful it is for us to be reminded that, you know, here's this woman, a prostitute. When you study Hebrews chapter 11 and And it's interesting to see her in verse 31, the last individual that's held up and portrayed before you, because it goes through all of these noble characters, you know. Consider Abel, consider Enoch, consider Noah, consider Abraham, consider Sarah, the only other woman. Consider Isaac, consider Joseph, consider Moses, consider Joshua. And lastly, after all of these noble personages are spoken of that we admire so much, lastly it says, and consider Rahab, the harlot, who perished not with the city, but received the spies in peace. It's almost like that's the capstone or the exclamation mark on all of these characters that are put before us, because the next verse says, what shall we say more of? And it goes on and just then elaborates, no more portraits of individuals. She's the last person held up there, and it's almost as though God is saying, you know, here is the great evidence of what can happen in any human soul in regards to coming to proper conviction, simply by hearing the word, and that I can reach down to the life of a harlot, to the lowest people in society, whatever they might be, and make them my own. And you need to remember that though you live on a wall that's going to crumble, that's scheduled to crumble, that when God sees the scarlet line on your life, when he sees the blood on your doorpost and lintel, that you will be preserved. Though the wall falls, you know what happened on that seventh day? Those walls came to the ground except for one pillar of stone with a harlot's house on top of it with a red rope hanging out the window. Those walls went down except that one place. And when the city was burned afterwards, she was spared. And though the wall that we've built our lives on, to some extent, these institutions may be crumbling, we know too that God will take us out before it burns. And how gracious he is. And how wonderful he is to remind us that he cares for the solitary harlot, the sinner, whatever condition, that cries out to him, that for 40 years he can wander through the wilderness and have his eye on a house on a wall where a harlot lives, waiting to come to the edge of the promised land. And before he destroys, send in his messengers of peace. Verse 16 says, she said to them, get you to the mountain. Well, verse 15. She let them down by a cord through the window, for her house was upon the town wall, and she dwelled upon the wall. And she said unto them, get you to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. In other words, what she's saying is, listen, leave the city, don't go towards the river, go up towards the mountains, because certainly they're going to be searching for you along the river, trying to get across to the children of Israel. Go west instead of east. Get you to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide yourselves there about 3 days until the pursuers are returned, and afterward, then go your way. And the men said unto her, we will be blameless of this thine oath, which thou hast made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, thou shalt bind this line of scarlet thread, rope, in the window, which thou didst let us down by. And thou shalt bring thy father, and thy mother, and thy brethren, and all thy father's household home unto thee. And how often that happens in our lives. I'm glad because, you know, in one sense, all of us are harlots. You know, a prostitute is just someone who sells a part of themselves for a price. And we've all done that to one degree or another. We've sold our time, we've sold our dedication, we've sold our health, our family, our finances, whether it was to success or money or a PhD or drugs or alcohol. There's a Rahab, as it were, in all of us. And how wonderful it is, I think, when God saves us and we see his grace, we see his love, that we can actually say to him, Lord, give me back my family. Restore the years that the locust has eaten away. I have been the offscouring, Lord, of my family. The black sheep, as it were, of my family. The one that they've turned their back on. The one they talk about at family reunions that I'm not invited to. Now, Lord, you're so gracious. You've stooped down to love me. Give me back my mother, my father, my household. Give them to me, Lord. Thou shalt bring thy father and thy mother, and thy brethren and all thy father's household home unto thee. And it shall be that whosoever shall go out of the doors of thy house into the street, his blood shall be upon his own head. We will be guiltless. Whosoever shall be with thee in the house, his blood shall be on our head, if any hand be upon him. And if thou utter this our business, then we will be released of the oath which thou hast made us swear. And she said, according unto your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed. And she bound the scarlet line in the window. How remarkable. How incredible. And they went, they came unto the mountain, and abode there 3 days, until the pursuers were returned. The pursuers sought them throughout all the way, but found them not. So the two men returned, descended from the mountain, passed over, and came to Joshua, the son of Nun, and told him all things that befell them. Now, again, this is a remarkable story. I can't imagine, you know, you think that he's sending them in for military, you know, to scrutinize things, and they come back with this story. No, we didn't see that. No, we didn't see that. No, we didn't see that. No, we didn't see any others. No, we didn't see that. What did you see? A prostitute. No. You don't understand. A believer, a sister, turned to our God, joined to our people. A daughter of Abraham. And she's given us all the strategy that we need. The land is before us. The inhabitants are terrified. They're melting. They have no courage. They have no will to stand before us. God had already sent a spy called Rahab into the situation. And they said unto Joshua, truly, the Lord hath delivered into our hands all the land, and they give her report. For even all of the inhabitants of the country do faint because of us. Giving Joshua Rahab's report on the whole situation. Now, it's interesting if you'll turn to Matthew chapter 1, we find that Rahab, and it's Christmas time, so we can go there. Rahab's mentioned 3 times in the New Testament, Hebrews 11:31, James 2:25, and here in Matthew chapter 1, beautifully. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob begot Judah and his brethren. And Judah begot Perez and Zerah of Tamar. And Perez begot Ezram, and Ezram begot Aram. And Aram begot Aminadab. And Aminadab begot Nahson. And Nahson begot Salmon. Now this man, Salmon, is a prince of the tribe of Judah. And Salmon begot Boaz of Rahab. And Boaz begot Obed of Ruth. And Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David, the king. Remarkable. Rahab becomes the grandmother of David, the king, a prostitute on the wall. God says, come, let us reason. Though your sins be as scarlet, they'll be white as wool. Though they be as crimson, they'll be white. It removes any excuse we have. And you know, even Christians, you know, it's remarkable. Sometimes I meet Christians who have been saved for years, and they still carry some reticence about completely trusting the love of Christ. You know, they still carry this place. Yes, I act the Christian act and I play the Christian role, but down inside of me there's a place that's still dirty, and I know that if I brought it out, everyone would realize it's the one thing that God will never get by in my life. No, God is so remarkable that he writes an entire chapter about a prostitute that lives on a wall and holds the chapter up in front of us and chronicles this woman's life so that we can follow her marrying into the tribe of Israel. It says in Joshua 6:25, so Joshua saved Rahab and her family alive because they helped the spies. And Rahab is amongst the children of Israel unto this day. It gives us the report. And we follow her then marrying into the tribe of Judah, giving birth to Boaz, who marries Ruth, who gives birth to Obed, who gives birth to Jesse, David's father, who gives birth to David, the king of Israel. Rahab, the harlot, the grandmother of David, the king. And that makes her, of course, the great, 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 14 great grandmother of Jesus, the Messiah of Israel. Isn't it interesting? You know, I know a lot of people who would not write their family tree if their grandmother was a prostitute. And it's interesting, you know, it says he's not ashamed to be called our God. I think sometimes of how ashamed or embarrassed we are to be open about our faith. It seems like it, doesn't it seem like it should be the other way around? That someone just would say, oh God, those are your people? But don't say that too loud. Let's not talk about that. You know, I have a sordid, you know, group. He's never ashamed. He writes it in bold print. Rahab, the grandmother of David the king, the great-grandmother of Jesus, the Messiah, the royal bloodline. Never ashamed to be called our God. Aren't you glad? I'm so glad that's the God that we serve. I'm glad that when anyone walks in these doors, and I don't care what they've done, you know, and some, you know, it's not sensationalized to say, hey, I was a drug addict, or Rob Bailetti was a heroin addict, or Jerry Paradise leading worship tonight. He was in a mental institution and a drug rehab center. You know, you meet Jerry, you think he was born Baptist with a tie on or something, you know, never did anything in his life. He was a lunatic, you know, but, you know, that's the story of Rahab. That's the story of so many. It's the story of, really, of God's love. It's the story of God's redemption and how powerful it is. Not of rehabilitation, but of transformation. And I'm thankful for that. And I'm thankful that that's the God he is. And I know that he stoops down to save anybody, and I want to help. I love it. The fields are white to harvest. The labors are few, the time is short, but the God we serve stoops, scrapes the bottom of the barrel. That's where he got me, and I'm glad he scrapes. To scrape up his sons and daughters. What a God we serve. How wonderful. You know, I pray that if you're here tonight and you don't know Christ personally, that before you leave, you would do that. You would come up and say, hey, if this God you're talking about is real, this isn't the God I learned about in church, I want to know who he is, if he loves me. I've sold myself. I've bowed the knee somewhere else. I've worshipped other gods. If he loves me, if he'll have me, if he'll write me into his family, I want to know who he is. We'd love to pray with you at the end of the service and give you a Bible. It says in chapter 3, Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from the acacia grove and came now to the brink of the Jordan River. He and all the children of Israel and lodged there before they passed over. And it came to pass after 3 days that the officers went through the host and commanded the people, saying, when you see the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then you shall remove from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits, 3,000 feet by measure. Come not near unto it, that, here's the reason, that you may know the way by which you must go. For you have not passed this way before. A very interesting situation now. They gather down by the river. Joshua talks to his leaders. They talk to the people. They tell them to prepare themselves. They sit there and they look at the river for 3 days, wondering, how are we going to get across this at flood tide? God lets them get an eyeful, because they need to know as they enter into the land that it has nothing to do with their strength, their ability, their resources. And then God says, through Joshua, the way we're going to do this is, when the priests, the Levites, pick up the Ark of the Covenant and begin to move, we will follow them. Give us about 3,000 feet, because if you crowd in 2 to 3 million people around it, nobody will know where it is. It's just a maddening crowd. Nobody knows what's going on. But they said, if we give it a space of about 3,000 feet, we'll be able to see the priests and the Ark of the Covenant in front of us, and we'll follow it down to the water. Very important. Now, yeah, and you have to understand, this is something that is entirely new. It's something that's never happened. This generation has grown up in the wilderness. The generation before them has perished in the wilderness. All of their lives, 38, 40 years, more for some of them, all of their lives they've been following a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, for the first time, Joshua is saying to them, Moses is gone. Joshua is saying to them, we're going to follow the ark now. Evidently, the pillar. We don't know whether it goes out at night or disappears during the day, but the pillar ceases. And now, for the first time, following an entirely different way. An entirely different way. Now we will follow the Ark of the Covenant. Put it out in front of us so we can see it. Don't crowd it. We want to see it. You want to keep your eye on it. You don't want to look at the river. You don't want to look at Jericho. You don't want to look at the impossibilities. We will follow the presence of the Lord. Remarkable, because what a picture it is of the law that had brought them this far. The law had brought them to the edge of the promised land, but Moses, the lawgiver, couldn't lead them in. It had to be Joshua, Jesus, that would lead them into the land. It would no longer be the means by which they were led all those years. Now they would follow by faith. It would be an entirely new way of moving, keeping their eyes on the presence of the Lord. And the presence of the Lord dwelt between the cherubim and the Ark of the Covenant. An entirely new system would be set up. Very strange for them. You and I read it, and I think how incredibly difficult it must have been for them to make these transitions at this point in time. And this is why God is going to part now the Jordan River, like he parted the Red Sea with Moses. And he's going to let them see that. It tells us the Jordan is flowing at its flood tide. No dams at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee. Again, when you see the Jordan River now, it snakes down the valley. It's 10, 15 foot wide. But when it overflowed its banks, all of those snakes were covered with water. And it's spread out in its width. And that, the Jordan River now, when they cross, when the priests put their feet into the brink of the river, it says the river will pile up. You're talking about the Jordan River in flood tide with all of its tributaries, and the bed of the river immediately becomes dry. They're not getting all mucked and caught in mud when they're going across. And the river, as they look at it, begins to pile up. Now, it's got to take probably at least 8 hours for 2 to 3 million people to cross. Imagining how many tons of water were piling up in a pile as the children of Israel were walking across. And did it take more faith if you were in the end of the line than it did if you were in the front of the line? If you were in the front of the line, it was strange because the river stopped flowing. Over the end of the line, 8 hours later, it must have been a big pile of water by then. But as Moses led them through the Red Sea, now they'll have this experience with Joshua. And God, using that, a new way of being led, having his word, having the book now, having the worship that God has instituted, the priests, the Levites bearing it, then you shall remove. Let a space there, 2,000 meters. You have not passed this way before. And Joshua said to the people, sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. Now, they must have said, what do you mean sanctify? What about target practice? What about building barges? What about sharpening arrows and swords? What do you mean, sanctify yourselves? You know, wouldn't it be great if the president did that? were getting ready to go to war. My heart is troubled. Human lives are at stake. I've asked the Congress and the Senate to begin to pray to sanctify themselves. And I want the entire nation, sanctify yourselves. The ACLU would be screaming, what do you mean? You have no right to tell us that. How wonderful that would be. Imagine the leader of a nation in the face of great adversity turning first to God. Sanctify yourselves. Pray. You know, there was some of that. There was some of that in 91 in the Persian Gulf crisis. There were some interesting things then as President Bush took Billy Graham with him and they prayed, asked the nation to pray. They say there were 54,000 conversions in the Gulf, men that turned to Christ. Some of that seems to cool off when the war's over. Sanctify yourselves. I like that. Joshua said to the people, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow. The Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua spake unto the priest, saying, take up the ark of the covenant and pass over before the people. And they took up the ark of the covenant and went before the people. And the Lord said unto Joshua, this day will I begin to magnify thee in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. And thou shalt command the priests that bear the ark of the covenant, saying, when you are come to the brink of the water of Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. And that's, we've come to the brink of 8:30 at this point in time. And we'll have to leave off at that point till next week. I imagine the people in Jericho looking over the wall, seeing the pillar of fire by night, the pillar of cloud by day, watching the children of Israel move down by the Jordan River. They must have seen the pillar disappear. Maybe they went, their God left. He's not with them. What's that stupid box those guys are carrying? And imagine watching from the walls of Jericho as they put their foot in the edge of the river to see the river split and dry up and see the water begin piling up. Uh-oh. Imagine. They were terrified of them before they came in. Imagine what it was like for the folks in Jericho to be witness to that as the children of Israel, 2 to 3 million, would cross over a period. They say if they were, I forget, a mile and a half or 2 miles abreast, that it would take 8 hours for that many people. Imagine. Now, the interesting thing is this for you to take note of. Rahab says twice, we have heard. And isn't it interesting? She's the only one out of the population of that city to turn her heart to the Lord. She said, we have heard. All of the rest of the inhabitants of Jericho rebelled against the fact that this God was the God of heaven above and earth beneath. Hardened their hearts. Same information. Same word. Same rumors. And yet here's one prostitute who becomes part of the royal family, the royal lineage. I think it takes away all of our excuses. I don't know where you are this evening. I don't know, maybe a friend dragged you here. I don't know if you know Christ personally. This takes away all of your excuses, though. Because, see, imagine if there was just one person here to believe. That would be nothing compared to one person in all of Jericho. And the woman that no one said, you know, no one would ever imagine she would be the one. You know what people would do? They would do what they do to us. You mean to tell me that I went to church my whole life, put the offering envelopes in the offering, helped the priest put the stained glass windows in, helped install the carpets, and that no good for nothing prostitute you hang around with is going to go to heaven because she accepted Jesus and I'm not? That's right, Dad. Not a popular idea. If you'd have told the inhabitants of Jericho, the only one that's coming out of this, that one up there on the wall, see that red rope? They said, you're out of your mind. We have double walls. Double walls. 40-foot high. Outside walls 10 foot thick, inside walls 15 foot thick. Ba-boom. Those walls came down, except for one part of the wall where that house was, with the red rope. That's where the red roof in came in from, or the red rope in. I don't know. You know, that's where, you know, how remarkable. How remarkable. And how remarkable that God holds her life up in front of us. And I think he beckons to our hearts and draws us to himself all over again. You know, as I studied through this chapter this week, God so warmed my heart. I thought, Lord, you're so amazing. Sometimes we're almost afraid to portray you that gracious to a lost world. And yet we need to remember that God so loved the world that drives us out of our minds and grieves us. God so loved that world that he gave his only son, that whosoever would believe would not perish but have everlasting life.